Thank you, Shelley. And good morning to everyone, and thank you for CEDA for having me today here. I think in the last 12 hours, both Shelley and myself have been probably disrupted. First of all, I guess the call that no doubt Shelley got in having to host the event at short notice. And then for me, when I sort of looked out of the window and I saw a sun, and I thought, well, that's a bit disruptive today. I'm actually used to the rain now all of a sudden. So I think that's going to take a bit of used to getting used to this week. In my speech for CEDA last June, I addressed digital disruption and the opportunities it presents for innovation and growth. I also covered some of the imperatives that executives and boards face in dealing with this disruption to ensure that their organisations flourish in this ever-changing landscape. But today, I'll examine how leadership styles themselves have actually been disrupted more recently, and with a new digital mindset arising, and how this differs from the traditional leadership approaches that we've seen. Whilst the fundamentals of leadership actually remain unchanged, there are some vital differences to come out of the digital environment that we're all operating in now. These differences are primarily arising from technology being applied in different ways. At the start of the digital revolution, we saw technology being used mainly for productivity improvements, to do things faster, cheaper, with improved quality. However, now through the application of digital technologies, entire business models are being changed. Some are disappearing within short timeframes, and new models are appearing just as quickly to address unmet customer needs. Often, these needs were not even known of beforehand. The examples of this change are numerous, and I won't go into the detail, but at a glance, you can just see across the industry, with Uber redefining the taxi industry without actually owning any cars. Airbnb, which has more rooms available to travellers than any of the hotel chains, doesn't actually buy or build any hotels. And then Freelancer, where members can submit and bid for project work on a global basis, purely via online interactions. But within the context of this technology disruption, there's another key factor at play, and that's the behaviour of the people in the workforce, including their expectations, their skills, their needs, and really their desires in what they expect from the workforce. All generations of leadership, however, have experienced their unique challenges. Generation Y entered the workforce around 1995. With a basic knowledge of the first wave of computing. The leadership challenge around that time was computer skills development, cross-training, new workforce practices. But Generation Z, often referred to as digital natives, who will be entering the workforce in the next 10 years, will bring even greater uncertainty. It's the first generation truly growing up in the mobile and internet age. And while we can look at the children of today and just speculate on their habits and their expectations and their behaviour in the workforce, only time will really tell. However, there's no doubt that whilst generations X and Y will continue to talk about digital disruption, and looking across, I guess, in the audience, I guess we're all part of that X and Y gen, Generation Z will come along and will wonder what all this fuss is about. To them, what we see as disruption is just business as usual. Being a leader in an organisation in this era brings some interesting challenges. New approaches to people management are a key success factor in today's digital economy, particularly when you have to deal with the behaviour, attitude and expectations of that new workforce. So with that sort of broad context of I guess, the digital transformations from technology and the expectations of the workforce, over the next 15 minutes, I'll cover three aspects of digital leadership. First of all, collaboration, then courage, and culture. Clearly, there's probably many other traits that we could discuss over the next 15 minutes. And some would argue that these are actually no different from traditional leadership. But given the emergence of digital natives in the workforce and the lessons that come out of the organizational successes and the failures, this is probably a good starting point to have a discussion. So let's first start with collaboration. There's a saying which goes along the lines of, it's not who you work for, but who you work with. This, in essence, sums up the imperative for leaders to encourage collaboration, not only within their own organizational unit, but also, more importantly, across the industry. A leadership style that inspires discussion, idea generation, inquiry, becomes crucial in the context of digital disruption. Many organizations that have prospered in this digital age have had a strong approach to engagement across their industry, either for harnessing ideas and possibilities, lining up partnerships for increased market share, research and development, or tapping into the talent pool around the world. This collaboration is in addition to, and not at the expense of, a mindset that protects the core intellectual property and know-how of the organization in a highly competitive environment. The approach of inventing it all yourself is not one that has prospered when you look at some of the organizational successes. There are many examples. Apple, that actually only designs their devices. It doesn't physically build them, but it relies on a sophisticated integration of suppliers upstream and downstream to get that done. Google, that relies on daily customer feedback on their online services and then reacts and adapts to that on a weekly basis. And then the numerous telecommunications companies that collaborate with phone manufacturers and retailers on launches, plans, and unique value propositions. In the digital economy, the difference in collaboration required from leaders stems from the fact that the ideas and the threats may not come from your own sector. In traditional leadership, this was largely the case, where you watched your competitors and you could see what was going to happen next. The insights and ideas may arise from a completely unrelated sector or an entrepreneurial source that can scale a startup in an unprecedented speed. Clear examples here include the fact that Uber was not started by bus companies to compete with the taxis. Airbnb was not set up by a leading hotel chain. And Apple was not a music company when it disrupted the music industry. And Amazon was an online bookstore, and yet now it's one of the leading IT cloud providers and challenging some of the traditional heavyweights of computing. So what's important for leaders in this era of collaboration? It's a clear understanding of the broader operating environment in a digital sense and what's happening in the economy. This now brings me on to the second aspect of digital leadership, courage. Courage has always been a key aspect of traditional leadership, but recent history shows that this is being tested even more now. Think about the Kodak discussion that hid the digital innovation they invented, or the choices in front of companies like HMV, Blockbuster, Borders, as the market turned digital. Should they fight or should they take flight? Clearly, some of these companies chose to wait and see, and we know what the end result was. Leaders in the digital economy need that extra dose of courage more now than ever before. They need an approach that's nimble, adaptive, and if required, can reconfigure or reimagine the business model. This comes from an attitude that encourages a test and learn approach. This is where seed projects and ideas may be allowed to grow and prove themselves, as long as there is also courage to either stop them as a write-off, or if they don't deliver value, or if projects show value, then having the courage to implement them. This isn't as easy as it may sound. Often the easiest decision is to continue an investment in a project right to the end and not stop it in the middle. And on the other hand, a project that does deliver and sometimes disrupts the business model and the historic revenue stream may actually be seen as an internal threat. There are many examples of this courage, and I'm sure as leaders you've faced many too. The ones that come to mind in more recent years, Apple resizing the iPhone to make it larger when the previous direction was actually heading the other way. Microsoft, traditional company in software, and it entering the hardware arena with the new Surface devices. And the many newspapers that are challenged by the choices between print and digital offerings. I suspect all of these directions would have demanded some courageous decisions. In fact, I'm sure there was probably some very heated internal debate, and you know, particularly around the status quo that was there in many of these organizations. Finally, moving on to the third aspect of digital leadership, which is around culture. Culture is an aspect of leadership that's been important for a very long time, but now has more prominence in the digital economy. This is primarily due to a younger, more tech-savvy workforce, and the fact that many ideas arise from them. In the past, the top-down management approach, driven by a clear vision statement, was the dominant leadership style. Today's employees don't just need a vision. They also need a challenge or a mantra they believe in, and one that allows them to compete. This includes having a very clear articulation of why the challenge or the need exists, and what this will do for the organization and the customers. And some in the innovation call this the why. So creating an environment that actively seeks input, encourages new ways of doing things, and offers a challenge becomes vital in this new world. Coupled with this, leadership that encourages ideas to flourish and progress without hindrance. Leadership that provides an environment for a diversity of views is also important, as it's this constant testing and refining that leads to better solutions ultimately. This approach also feeds the new thirst that digital natives have in the workforce for feeling engaged and valued and wanting to express their view. And often feeding this leads to many other related untapped ideas and views being captured. This was so visibly seen recently in the hashtag the dress, which simply started off on a view on a dress in terms of its color, but that generated far more interactions and social media discussion on perspectives, diversity, and attitudes across various societies. And leadership on culture requires focus across two primary dimensions. The first is hardwiring, which includes the policies and the regulations and the rules that govern a society or an organization. In a society sense, this is about leadership in laws and rules that encourage startups to flourish without inhibitors, allowing their home presence to be retained as they become successful. It's also about leadership in education curriculums that encourage and develop an entrepreneurship skill set in the schools, in the TAFEs, and the universities. For organizations, hardwiring is about leadership agreeing the digital strategy up front in a conscious manner. For a board, this is as important as the risk appetite statement that many of us would have seen in the past. So will you be a leader of change and disrupt your own and others' business model? Will you be a fast follower and follow other firms' innovations? Or will you simply incrementally apply continuous improvement for efficiency and effectiveness? These are questions that have material consequences for leadership. The second dimension is soft wiring, which refers to the behaviors and attitudes necessary for dealing with digital in this era. In a society, this is about developing a culture that accepts digital change, which supports budding entrepreneurs to pitch ideas, gain feedback, and grow. This requires a mindset change, an acceptance that startups may fail, and an attitude that it's okay for them to start again. For many in the Silicon Valley, the number of startups an individual has been part of is seen as a valuable and saleable credential, not as a black mark on their ability. This clearly is a new paradigm for us, and whereas traditional leadership may see these as failures. Organizational soft wiring is about the culture that the leaders create to encourage and motivate people and to pursue not only their workplace objectives but also their personal passions. There's a lot of talk about work-life balance, but in the disruptive world, there is a blurred line between this. And companies that manage to convince people of the mantra and the purpose of their vision and instill a passion in that also help in setting that up in their personal lives as well, in being able to motivate people. So in looking at the three areas, collaboration, courage, and culture, I just wanted to conclude with a few closing remarks around that. Leadership needs to evolve to embrace these new approaches demanded by the digital economy. This is not about forgetting the traditional approaches to leadership, but it's about building upon them. You could call this two-speed leadership. And successful leaders in the digital age prosper most with a new focus on collaboration, on courage, and culture. With collaboration, it's actively ensuring this happens. With courage, it's being able to make the difficult decisions often very quickly with many unknowns. And with culture, it's extending the vision to a passion for staff to own and drive. In particular, though, leadership in the digital era is where business-savvy technologists and technology-savvy business coexist. This doesn't mean you have to be able to do the job of the other profession, but it does require people to have an appreciation of the crossover and the value each adds. Understanding the concepts and the possibilities of social, mobile, data, and cloud become a necessity for the business. And an appreciation of funding, cost, and customer needs become the technologist's imperative. Some may argue that leadership required in the age of digital disruption is no different from the past. And it's about vision, strategy, people, and delivery. They may well be right, but when you look more deeply, the leadership of today requires a lot more. The speed and nature of the change we experience now warrants this. And when traditional leaders are afraid of technology or don't quite understand the opportunities or the threats it brings, the difference required in leadership becomes much more clearer. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Sir. I'm just interested to know how you applied some of those concepts and changes within the RBA, as a leadership team, and particularly given your charter, and whether that is difficult to do given some of the constraints that you have as an organisation.
The aspects that I've talked about are very much relevant to most organisations. It's the degree to which they are applied. Culture is one where we do have a strong focus in understanding the needs and learning behaviours of the different demographics across the organisation. And that's where we do, for example, have more of a highly interactive approach in getting viewpoints and ideas from the younger cohort who join the organisation. And also getting views from them on how to go about in developing solutions. So there's a lot of interaction. And an example is we have regular lunch and learn sessions, which are oversubscribed when we have them, and we have to rehold them. And those are ideas generation and conversation sharing ideas. And we've also run internally, internal competitions for coding amongst to generate a level of excellence around our technical work, but I think culture is the key one around excellence, reputation, and being able to do your best, where we can actually bring the traditional side of management and also a newer, more interactive approach to bear within the organisation, and that's actually having a lot of positive effect.
Hi, I'm Leanne Robb from KingCare. Just, you talk about collaboration. How do you manage the balance between allowing your people to collaborate, because that's where ideas are generated, and the need for them to pull away for quiet time and actually to do some of that deeper thinking? Because it's a hard balance to manage to support people to collaborate, but also to allow them that capacity to actually go for a deep dive on what they're doing.
Part of that is the physical environment in offering, I guess, people environments which are highly interactive and they can share a space, common area, just to have discussions across with other people in the team, and then offering them a quieter environment to actually contemplate and think and plan. And that's sort of more within the organization. But the approach, I guess, across industry, if you're collaborating across industry, is actually having the time to reflect and come back and say, look, what did we learn out of that interaction? What was the other organization doing well? What was it not doing well? How can we help the other organization? How can it help us? So it's actually having that moment of reflection when you're engaging with other organizations. But then more importantly, having an appreciation of who they are engaging with, I think is key in the collaboration as well, because it is a chain. But I think the question is more around how do you actually pause and contemplate and create action. And I guess that's really comes from a physical separation for a period and thinking about it, but also reflecting and saying, so what did that do? It was a nice chat with this other organization, but what did we actually learn?
Thanks, Art. Part of the digital opportunity is about being more user and customer centric. How have you driven that within the culture of your organization?
our environment, I guess, is quite unique. In terms of internally, we do a lot of prototyping and getting input from the internal users on what a solution should look like, and demonstrating an early version, getting input on that, and that's helped us iterate internally in some of the systems that we develop. More broadly, though, across the industry, it's actually seeking feedback. So whilst that may seem as business as usual, it is in a way iterating, getting viewpoints, then bringing those together, synthesizing those, and saying, look, this is where we want to head now as an economy. So it's sort of different levels of interaction and feedback, but it's really largely around an iterative or test and learn type approach, whether it's the scale across the country or whether it's internal to the organization. But most importantly, accepting that the feedback, some of it actually would need to be addressed as part of the next iteration. It's no good taking the feedback from your users, internal users or other stakeholders, and then not doing anything about it. Now, that doesn't mean you have to address everything, but certainly being able to address the bits that improve your solution is vital. And that's the whole test and learn approach.
Hi, Sav. Thank you, and thank you, Shelley. I'm Chelsea Ford from Diabetes New South Wales. I actually have two questions, if I'm allowed. First of all, you spoke about having a coding competition. Just wondering, are you seeing new recruits have the skill set in the first place to keep up with the level of innovation and disruption that you spoke about?
We're finding certainly the new recruits do have the appetite and the skill set to innovate, and also both in technical terms but also the soft skills, because innovation requires technical and soft skills, and they do have that. the trick is giving them a challenge, because they all like challenges, the younger generation coming through, and so finding business problems that are worth solving for them is really the challenge for leadership, and our approach to the codathon was really around getting the business to come up with some internal improvement opportunities, and as part of a working group with the business, we then picked the top 10 ideas that could do with a bit of prototyping and a bit of coding, and I think around 70 to 80 then. Staff got into groups and decided to give it a go over 12 hours, and with lots of pizzas and cans of Coke. And so, so they have the appetite, but it's creating the environment for them to come up with the solutions. And that was a well-received exercise in terms of building the culture, solving a few problems for the business, but more importantly, giving the staff the opportunity to grow themselves. In an internal but competitive environment where they were actually looking at what the other group was doing across the floor in prototyping their solution.
Thank you.
You've got the mic, you might as well carry on.
The other question I had, you spoke about courage, particularly leaders' courage, and the Apple example of going bigger with the phone when the direction was going the other way. I'm kind of curious around how you see we can support leaders to have that courage.
I think the courage, it comes from probably mentoring, and but I wouldn't just say the traditional form of mentoring, where you have someone who's more experienced, but the concept of reverse mentoring, and certainly I've seen, you usually find the younger entrants want a more senior mentor, but the ones that are successful, the younger person actually ends up mentoring the older person on technology matters, and so whether it's on social media, on what's happening out there, and so on. So that actually helps give confidence to leaders that this actually, it sort of demystifies all of this change in the digital world. And so reverse mentoring, I think, actually does have some merits, but it's hard to set up in the right way. That sort of helps the courage factor of some very senior leaders, and I've known leaders in the recent past who've actually had that in place. It's easier for them to ask a person at work what four squares is than asking their children, who might not give them the answer. You know.
Hello, Tim Park from IAG. Just in a very collaborative environment, traditional leadership's, you know, focused on reward, recognition, the development opportunities go to the best and the brightest. In a very collaborative world, how do you measure that, or do you have to change your thinking on how your HR practices operate?
I think it's more around recognition and opportunity that are the drivers in that sense. That certainly in my travels, and so it's not necessarily the financial reward or the. It's actually giving someone an opportunity, and it could be a rotation into another part of the organisation for a period. It could be a secondment to one of your suppliers for a short period. But it's setting it up so that they feel that they've earned it in a competitive way, and then there's something for them at the end in terms of a new experience. So that sort of assumes, yes, your remuneration and other, you know, benefits are reasonable, but giving people the opportunity is actually, I think, far more reward in setting them up for the future, and also having them being more appreciative. And I know in our experiences, many of our graduates aspire to, at some early stage in their career, to do further education, whether it's an MBA, an MSc, and them getting those kinds of things in place as a consequence of them excelling or achieving something is actually highly regarded.
Sorry, but in a collaborative environment, do you reward the team or the individual who leads the team? How do you kind of assess the contributions?
I think it has to be at both levels. It's difficult. I mean, the outcome is for the team, so the team has to celebrate. There's no doubt about that. But I think at some point, individuals in that team also need a level of recognition. We, for example, do it. We have quarterly recognition awards within the technology department. Some of those are team-based, but there are equally individual-based. And you've got to recognize that, because once the project or the collaboration objective is over, the people are individuals until the next team is formed. So motivating them for the next team event is actually critical. And that's where it's getting the balance right between that.
We've heard a lot about culture and collaboration, and it's all great, but I'm going to have a paradox here. We were expecting the results of the startup world, which is dominated by a small number of very passionate, driven founders, to be then worked in the same model. Aren't we at risk of adopting a model that doesn't work in the culture of collaboration?
I think, and you know, and maybe PwC might have a view as well, but I think within larger organisations, it's not being able to do this in a small manner is probably the way to go about it, and not try and change the whole culture. And some call it, you know, innovation at the edge, or building an environment as a part of the organization where you can apply more innovation and idea generation, collaboration. But there would be certainly a part of the organization which actually needs to do things in a traditional way, in a more structured way, with specifications, with structure, with quality built in, you know, at every stage. And so it's working out which part of your organization needs to move in a startup fashion, and which part of your organization needs to be stable, reliable, fully secure, and so on. And that for us is obviously a key consideration, is which parts of the environment can we innovate in and give our users some new tools to experiment with, and which platforms, like payments, banking, markets, which platforms, where do we actually want full reliability, stability, and security? So it's working out those two spectrums in your organization, but you're absolutely right, you can't suddenly turn a 100-year-old organization into a culture of a startup. I mean, that's doomed to failure.
Yeah, well, it echoes this last point, Sarah. I mean, the approach that we've very much taken is, where can you get a small group of people who are interested and engaged in innovation, and let them work with segments of the business and make sure that you incubate properly, but you maintain the success of the rest of your business? And how can you pull the best of startups? So that's working agile. It's not spending in your traditional cost structures. So you bring those best parts of the startup, but you very much want people that love your business, that are engaged with your clients, and can figure out how to marry the two. But finding that passionate entrepreneur that's willing to unlock their ideas and bring the best of themselves to your business is no mean feat to get there and do it successfully. It's a very valid point.
Hi, Inga Weber from NICTA. I have sort of a follow-up question. A lot of the startups nowadays are very successful because they do one thing, focused with very good user experience. For example, Booking.com only does hotel bookings, whereas traditional organizations typically have broader solutions integrated. How do you deal with that contrast?
Look, I think ultimately that's then, as startups in the single product sense become more successful, I guess they try and diversify. And so that's really a business decision, in terms of, should they diversify and develop other products, or should they actually continue to specialize? And I suspect those that continue to specialize end up getting bought out by the ones that are chosen to diversify. But I think that's really a strategy decision. I would suggest both can be successful. It's really a strategy-related question. But each of them carries, you know, as you expand into different product set, then the product sets and services, then the courage and the culture question becomes even more important. Is how do you retain that as you grow into different products?
Thank you. It's always with CC. Just a question picking up on the comment before about the startup. I'm interested in the transition of, I guess, skills and IP. So you have the innovation and the startup team, and then you have your other teams, and that transition of moving an innovative idea into business as usual, and how you, I guess, upskill those other teams to take that up. Any thoughts on that?
Certainly in my experience is having a clear understanding of what are the minimum, standards to industrialize that idea that you've created in a startup world. Do you have to make it more secure? Do you have to make it more available, more quality? It's just understanding that line. And that's where I think a lot of organizations struggle, is that when they haven't set that minimum level, is they can end up, when they scale, with a poor product, which might have worked in the labs and in some JAD sessions, but when you try and then develop it as a product, it just needs industrialization. But it's knowing what that is, because if you add too much, then it might just completely negate the value proposition of that product. So it's a tough one, And you can't build all of those controls and rigor right up the front because you'll be doing all of that and not the innovation. But maybe for as part of the innovation, agreeing what does the future look like for that is probably a good starting point.